Hello, and thank you for listening to our podcast in support of our production of Perfect Arrangement. This is the third and final installment of our podcast, and I hope you've listened to the other two. If you haven't, I encourage you to take some time and go back and listen to those as we get prepared for the show. In today's episode, I talk to Christopher Brooke, who's the legal director of the ACLU of North Carolina, and I'm excited for you to hear what he has to say. And I've also got some surprise guests at the end of today's podcast that I can't wait for you to hear from. So here we go, my interview with Christopher Brooke. All right, now I'm speaking with Christopher Brooke, who is the legal director of the ACLU of North Carolina. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Chris, I heard that you performed at RLT back in the day. Is that right?
It's true. I'm now continuing a relationship with RLT that began, I guess, around a quarter century ago. But seriously, it's always been such a wonderful part of our community, and it's wonderful to get to play a role, albeit quite a different one, that I played when I was in middle school.
Well, we're glad to have you. As you know, the play deals with workplace discrimination. Really, the Lavender Scare of the 1950s, where the State Department started identifying sexual deviance, which was really code for the LGBTQ community at the time. And so I wanted to speak with you a little bit about how this play remains relevant today, and how your work at the ACLU still addresses some of these issues. So can you tell us a little bit about how your work as the legal director intersects with the LGBTQ community now?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, at the most general level, what we're fighting for at the ACLU of North Carolina is total and complete day-to-day lived equality for the entire LGBTQ community. So that means that LGBTQ students should be treated equally and fairly in their studies. LGBTQ customers who are seeking to take advantage of public accommodations, be it, you know, go out to eat with their family or check into a hotel with their family, should be treated equally and fairly. And also ensuring that LGBTQ individuals are treated equally and fairly in the workplace. And, you know, one of the things that makes RLT putting this play on so important is that it remains a timely issue. We have, of course, made great strides as a nation and here in North Carolina as a state in regards to LGBTQ equality, but we still do not have clear workplace protections for the LGBTQ community. And that raises the specter that you could, for example, get married over the weekend and then be fired on Monday for having a photo of your same-sex spouse on your desk. And we are trying to clarify the law in regards to that and clarify it such that no one can ever be fired at work because of who they love, and more broadly, that employees are judged based on the quality of their work, not based on their sexual orientation or the fact that they're a member of the LGBTQ community.
So are those some of the ways you still see this discrimination manifest today that you're describing? Do people really have the power to fire folks for displaying pictures on their desks?
So it's unclear, and this remains a topic of great controversy in our courts. Title VII prohibits employers from engaging in discrimination against certain protected classes, race, religion, and sex, for example. And over the time since that it has been adopted, you know, sex has been robustly defined by the courts and to include that, you know, you should not be engaging in pernicious sex stereotyping based on against an employee, and also just directly that you should not be treating employees differently based on any sort of sex-based considerations. And so based on those sort of developments in the law, what we've argued is that, listen, the ultimate sex stereotype is that men should be romantically attracted to women and vice versa. And so, you know, the gay and lesbian bisexual community deviate from that very particular sex stereotype. You know, also we argue in the courts and have argued successfully that, you know, this is really per se sex discrimination because if, you know, a man put a photo of his wedding to a woman on his desk at work, there would be no problem whatsoever. It only becomes a problem for members of the LGBT community if they have a homophobic employee, if that photo is of their male spouse. So, you know, sex is obviously involved. And then there's just sort of an associational argument that we have made. The associational argument that we've made really originates out of the cases that struck down bans on interracial marriage and found that that was, you know, race discrimination. In this case, what the sex discrimination at play is really telling gay and lesbian bisexual men or women who they can associate with and whether they can associate intimately with members of the same gender. And if you fire somebody because they have associated with members of the same gender, then you really are, at bottom, engaged in sex discrimination. So we put forward those arguments. Those arguments have frequently been successful in the courts, but there's not a Supreme Court ruling on that. We actually are engaged in litigation right now in North Carolina to ensure that the protections of Title VII extend to the full LGBTQ community.
Wow. That's amazing, Christopher, and thank you for doing that work. You know, when I was talking to the playwright, Topher Payne, he talked about how excited he is to have a production here in North Carolina, particularly having followed what the state's come through and still wrestling with in some ways with HB2. And his kind of assertion, and when I asked him why that was exciting for him, was, you know, he talked about there's not any experience that's mentioned in the play with the shame and the hiding and the discrimination that's not being levied pretty directly on the transgender community right now. Can you speak to kind of what the temperature is in the state at the moment with the transgender community and with the partial repeal of HB2 and what effects that's having?
Yeah, absolutely. The temperature, you know, obviously has been very high here in North Carolina over the last year and a half, and that's part of the reason it's so important that RLT is putting on this play, so that we can reflect on the fact that though some of these issues seem new, at bottom, really the argument is quite an old one, and one that we've been grappling with as a society for so long. But you know, obviously the legislature passed HB2, which prohibited protections for the LGBT community at the local level broadly. It also, you know, came up with a birth certificate regime that oftentimes would have forced transgender individuals in North Carolina to utilize a restroom that does not accord with their gender identity. So really the wrong restroom that is not going to be, that's not going to work for them, is going to be unsafe for them to utilize. HB 142 continued that prohibition on local anti-discrimination protections. It got rid of the birth certificate regime for bathrooms, but it replaced it with a very confusing regime that leaves the transgender community really unprotected and a little bit unclear about how they should just go about their lives and their business on a day-to-day basis. So We've filed lawsuits against both HB2 and then again about HB 142. We're making some of the similar arguments that, listen, when you target trans folks, you're, again, perpetuating sex stereotypes about what quote-unquote real men and quote-unquote real women are like. But that you, again, are also sort of telling our clients that they are not the gender with which they identify. So you're engaging in sort of direct, per se, sex discrimination. So making some of the same arguments that have proven successful for the LGB community and extending those arguments to the trans community. But, you know, the thing that's striking to me is obviously we have made a lot of progress in regards to combating discrimination against the LGB community. There's far more work to be done and work to be done in the workplace. But you talked previously about the State Department policy from the mid-20th century about, acting against deviance, and that obviously being targeted at the LGB community. That same rhetoric, the same rhetoric that members of the LGBTQ community are somehow mentally ill, rhetoric that was used against, in particular, the LGB community in the 20th century, in the 20th century workplace and more broadly in society, is now being focused in particular on the transgender community. The debate that surrounded in our legislature, HB2 and HB 142, really made those same charges of deviancy and mental illness that are first in no way based in reality, based in fact, but are exceptionally stigmatizing to the trans community. So we've made progress, but when I, thought about this play and the reason that people were excluded from the State Department in the 20th century for being LGB individuals, I, was struck by how similar the arguments, 60, 70 years ago were that are being against the LGB community, how similar they are to the arguments that are being made today against the transgender community and full transgender equality.
So, yeah, I hear what you're saying about the discrimination and how it's still really relevant, and the same arguments are being applied to the transgender community. And it's interesting, like, now working on the play and having the actors in the room, just some of the conversations we've been in. And as we attack this primary question in the play, which is, what are you as a person willing to do? What are you willing to sacrifice for justice and for good, and to fight some of these social pressures of the time that you're living in? I'm just kind of curious, from your perspective, what you would say to those of us who ask the question, what can we do? What should we do to stand up for the LGBT community as a whole, but particularly the transgender community, as they're faced with some of the similar discrimination that we see in the play?
Well, I think that the most important thing is absolutely education. So discussions like the one that we're having today, discussions such as the ones that will accompany the play when it's put on at RLT, discussions that the play will engender when people are driving home from having seen it. I really very strongly believe that those discussions are every bit, and in fact actually more important, than discussions that happen within the courtroom or discussions that happen in legal filings. Because at bottom, what has produced legal victories for the LGBTQ community has been better understanding by the broader society about the LGBTQ community. And it's been really the LGBTQ community shouldering an exceptional burden and stepping forward and saying, I'm not going to live in the closet. This is who I am. This is my life. I pose no threat to anyone. And listen, those conversations have been so effective in changing the narrative around things such as same-sex marriage. And we've seen the results that those have produced in courts and in our society at large. The transgender community is obviously an exceptionally marginalized and smaller community and not a well-understood community. One of the things that I think has been a silver lining from the HB2 and HB142 conversations have been that North Carolinians have gotten to hear from folks like our plaintiffs challenging those pieces of legislation, hear from Joaquin Carcano, the lead plaintiff, hear from Peyton McGarry, who's also part of the lawsuit, hear from Hunter Schaefer. And, you know, what folks understand after those conversations occur is the folks with very similar aspirations to everyone else pose no threat to anyone else. And I think folks are forced to grapple with the real profound inequities that measures like HB2 and HB142 visit upon our LGBTQ friends and neighbors. And I think that's why things like the play are so important as well, because they make the stakes clear, they make the human interests clear, and make everyone sort of take a step back and think about where they are on these issues.
That's great. You know, and that's one of the reasons I really love art and love theater, is because I feel like it brings us into the same room together to have some of these hard dialogues. And, you know, one of the things that I think Topher was saying as we talked was just the power of sitting in a room together and starting a conversation. And, you know, he does that by creating a little bit of laughter as he tells these folks stories, and I think stories are insanely powerful. So and another thing that he says is the things don't really start to fall apart in the play until the characters stop working together. So what you're saying is inspiring me in the same way, saying, you know, it really takes us making concerted effort to work together, to talk with each other, to try to gain a new understanding, and that is a way to participate in activism. That's encouraging.
Yeah, if it wasn't for protesters marching the street, if it wasn't for the arts community stepping up and telling beautiful stories and telling painful stories, telling powerful stories, if it wasn't for individuals who have been, who are part of the LGBT community and have been on occasions treated unfairly, because of who they are. Without those protesters, without those artists, without those individuals, none of the progress that we make in courtrooms is possible.
That's inspiring. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for your work and for taking the time to record this podcast with us today. We appreciate your support of the play and just everything you're doing to fight for equal rights in the state. And I'm excited for you to see the play.
I can't wait, Patrick. It's always great to get to go back to my old stomping grounds at RLT. But, you know, I just can't thank Raleigh Little Theater enough for not only being such a resource for artists in the community, but also being such a resource for forcing us to strive as a community to live up to our aspirations.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right, everybody. So I'm here with my special guests, Amelia Ciandra and Lauren Knott, who play Norma Baxter and Millie Martindale in the play. Hi, y'all.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me. Thanks for being my special guests.
Of course.
I've never been a special guest before, so this is very special for me.
Let's start with you, Amelia. Can you tell us a little bit about what drew you personally to the play, and then a little bit about Norma?
Sure. What drew me to the play is that a lot of the people in my life who are the most important to me find themselves somewhere on the LGBTQ spectrum. And so when I read this play, I was really drawn to participate as an ally. And I think the sort of scary thing is that a lot of what these characters are afraid of is still happening today. What's going on in Chechnya and what it's like to be homosexual in many countries still around the world is really frightening. And so we take a few steps forward every once in a while in the United States and then a few steps back. So it feels like it's still prescient, even though it was set in 1950. And I think it's an important story. And like Topher said, to tell this story in the South, in the state of HB2, it's an important thing. And I'm really glad to be a part of that theatrical activism. And Norma is an incredible tough gal. She's sort of a Gal Friday for Millie's husband, and that's in air quotes, fake husband, Bob Martindale, at the State Department. And it's quite clear, as we're discovering through the play, that she is, even though she works for Bob, they are definitely partners in what they do. And at the beginning, what they do is root out communists, and then it becomes something else. And so she's sort of faced with her own dislike of her world and how she wishes the future could be something different. And that's sort of her journey in the play.
So Lauren, well, thank you for that, Amelia. I appreciate that. Lauren, tell us a little bit about what drew you to the play and a little bit about your character.
Well, I think the first thing that drew me to the play is that you were directing it, Patrick, of course. And as soon as I got the script, I just thought it was such a fun, interesting story and about a piece of history that I was not aware of. So the first thing I did once I read the script was go Google the Lavender Scare. And as a queer woman, like, this is a part of my history that I knew nothing about. And so I think getting the chance to tell this story is so important. And like Topher said, and like Amelia just mentioned, I mean, I grew up queer in North Carolina. And I remember when you mentioned HB2, but I remember when Amendment 1 was passed. I was 15. Mm. My little 15 bisexual self was sitting alone in my room and just, I heard that news and I just felt so unwanted. And like there was something, not that there was something wrong with me, I'd accepted that part of who I was, but like no one was ever going to accept it. And so I think doing a play that gets to explore some of that side of my identity, which I think is a very important part of who I am, it's not something I get to see on stage. So I'm excited for people to see it on stage, and I'm excited to get to do it myself on stage. So yeah, that's why I decided to do the play.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit about Millie.
Millie. Millie's the greatest character in the whole show, other than Kitty.
Rude.
They laugh, but it's true. Millie is plays a very typical, ditzy, stupid housewife, but she's so ferociously intelligent. And maybe she's not as book smart as Norma and Bob, but she understands people. She does a lot of listening in the play, which is good and hard for me as an actor, but she just sort of absorbs and synthesizes all of this information in this really tough, troubling, scary time for this family and has to make some important decisions. And I think she makes the right ones.
One of the things that we wanted to do on our season, as we were planning this last year, is to, we always want to tell stories that reflect our entire community. And we were really excited to find this one because of its focus on the LGBTQ community. But as our former board president, who was the president when we were selecting this, read the play, she was like, you know, I also think it's like a really feminist play. And I wonder if you all agree with that and how that manifests itself in the play, if that's true.
Well, I think the issue of intersectionality is so important. And I feel like when we get LGBTQ stories, they are very often stories of white cisgendered men who love white cisgendered men. And there's definitely misogyny within the gay community that is not addressed and needs to be addressed. And so I was thrilled when I read the play that it is set in the lesbian couple's home. And so a lot of the action is the lesbians. So getting to explore something that is not just about white cis men is really exciting for me.
I also think the play is feminist because, first of all, you have two incredible characters like Norma and Millie. But really, you have Barbara Grant. Mm. And Barbara Grant is the queen of the play. And she is a fabulous, powerful, unashamed woman who has nothing but disdain for people hiding who they are. And she wants everybody to live their truth. And as a catalyst, she is an incredible force on both Norma and Millie. And so, and eventually even the men. And so there is something, I think, incredibly heroic about her and then the journey that both Norma and Millie go on. And that is inherently feminist for the play to be ultimately decided by the action of the play is ultimately decided by the women. And our characters have a lot of conversation about this almost battle of the sexes that's happening. Are we on the same side as the men? And ultimately we're not, and ultimately we're right. So that's feminism. Women being right. No, I'm kidding,
oh,
obviously.
Gosh. Oh, gosh.
I'm kidding, obviously, but what I mean is women having the ability to have a voice and make decisions for themselves independently of the men that they are, even though it's fake, married to. Mm. That's an important thing, especially in 1950.
And they're just well-written women.
Right.
So often women have to fall into these boxes, these tropes. But these are women. And there's also this idea that the only feminist portrayal of a woman is a strong woman. And she has to punch things and fight everybody. But, like, that's not feminist necessarily. That's something women can be. But that's not something all women are. I think Norma's leans a little bit more that way. But women are allowed to be soft. Women are allowed to be flawed. Women are allowed to cry and stay home and want babies, and all of that is fine. They can also work, they can also fight people. So I think we get a variety of women in the show.
Yes, and even, I should mention, of course, even Kitty, who is could be at first read as the least feminist character because she's the really ditzy housewife who goes along with whatever her husband says, she has a little bit of authority in her own story that you get and see from her, and that is a really beautiful moment in the play. And demonstrates, I think, you know, if you want a play that's feminist, you just need complex women who are more than just the roles that they're written for, mother, wife, whatever. And that is what you get here. And I think that's really the most important thing. And, you know, you want to talk about the Bechdel test. This play passes it in spades. You know, it's flying colors. It's A++++++, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, why do you think people should see it? Aside from the fact that you two are in it and you're amazing, what about the story speaks to who we are now? I mean, why should we care about this story now?
I think we should care about this story now because it's still the story now. Like I said earlier, we take two steps forward and we go one step backwards. So we're fighting a lot of the same battles still. And allegorically, maybe we're not fighting the battles entirely for gay people, but for trans people and for any other minorities that are left behind. This play is saying quite a lot about that and about giving them a voice. And that's, I think, what makes it prescient and important. And really, it shows an ugly underbelly of America that we are, that every day it feels like we're seeing more and more of. And it, I think, only by, you know, facing our ugly truths can we actually start to fix them. And I think that that's what this play does. It's a comedy, but it's not really. There's a lot of funny parts, but in the end, it is trying to say something, and I think it achieves saying something really powerful and disturbing about what we have to do to change and make a better future.
Also, the costumes are really beautiful.
That's true.
Yes.
And also very important.
Incredibly beautiful, yes.
Yeah, you know, when I was talking with Chris from the ACLU, who's on this podcast as well, And James Miller, the executive director of the LGBT Center, also kind of reiterated this, which I totally agree with, and goes along with what you're saying. You can argue cases in court, or with your family, or with people that you care about, with statistics and facts and all that. But really, it's people's stories that motivate change. Well, thank you both for joining us on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right, listeners, thank you so much. That was our final podcast for our production of Perfect Arrangement. I'd like to thank Christopher Brooke, Amelia Siandra, and Lauren Knott for being our guests today. I hope that you've had a chance to listen to all three of these podcasts. If not, go back and listen to the other two, as it'll give you some great context for the play and some insight into why we chose it at this time. We are thrilled to be presenting it. I wanted to remind you of the dates. It opens on October 27th and runs through November 12th, and it will be in the Sutton Theater. So please join us. My name is Patrick Torres. I'm the Artistic Director of Raleigh Little Theater, and thank you for listening.